Welcome back to the Armchair Trader podcast. And this week we're talking about investment trusts, and we have the opportunity to really have a little bit more of a detailed look at investment trusts. They're not something everybody's familiar with. If you've been interested in the idea of investment trusts, but you're wanting to learn more, then this is the place to come. On the podcast today, we have Annamel Brodie-Smith, who's joining us from the Association of Investment Companies, which is the trade body for the UK investment trust sector. Welcome to the podcast, Annabelle.
Delighted to be here.
So really, what I wanted to do with the podcast today is really drill down a little bit more into, for investors, what an investment trust actually is, because there's going to be a lot of people out there who are very ignorant of them and really don't know what they are or what they do. So can you give us a sort of a brief overview of what is an investment trust?
Absolutely. So it's a company, just like any other company, listed on the stock exchange, but its sole purpose is to invest in a portfolio of assets. And they could be shares, or they could be properties or infrastructure projects, that sort of thing. And there's a fixed pool of capital, so there's a fixed number of shares in issue. So you buy and sell the company just like any other company on the stock exchange. So when you're buying, somebody else is selling the shares, and when you're selling, somebody else is buying. And that's an important difference, because unlike a unit trust or an OEIC, which increases or decreases in size automatically according to people buying or selling, with an investment trust, you've got that fixed pool of capital, which has advantages. It allows you to invest in sort of very suitable for real assets like property or private companies or infrastructure. There's also some income advantages. And as a company, there's a board of directors who are there to look after your interests. And we've seen directors being very proactive recently. For example, last year, there were 26 fee changes with directors working in the best interest of their shareholders. And as it's a company, you can also have a say in how your company is run. So you can vote, you can attend the AGM, and you can ask questions. So that's a very quick run through of what an investment trust is.
And the relationship between the fund manager and the investment trust, you've already mentioned there's a board of directors, they're independent, they're there to look after the interests of the shareholders. We see some fund managers launching investment trusts. At the same time, we see other managers advising investment trusts, but they're not in as much control of the investment trust as, say, they might be of their own mutual funds. How does that relationship stack up, and what's in it for the fund manager?
Well, it's really interesting, because you're quite right. I mean, it's the board of directors who actually appoints the fund management group, and they oversee the trust on behalf of their shareholders. Now, for the fund management group, the advantages for them is it's a fixed, as I said, a fixed pool of assets. So their fees are also fairly stable on those assets. Also, if you get a fund manager away from the fund management group and you ask them which vehicle you enjoy managing, is it the investment trust or the open-ended vehicle, the unit trust or the OEIC? Inevitably, they will say the investment trust. And that's because they enjoy having that fixed pool of capital. They know how much money they're going to manage. They can be patient. You know, if markets are tough, they're not a forced seller. They can hold on to those assets. They can also look at some of the benefits of the structure, like gearing, which means borrowing to invest in assets. So that's when times are tough. Unlike an open-ended fund where when times are tough, they would be meeting redemptions, people wanting to sell out, and they'd have to sell some of those best assets. It also works in the reverse when times are good. The open-ended manager, the OEIC manager, has to buy more assets, whereas the investment trust manager can perhaps hold off and wait for better opportunities. So if you talk to the managers, they really like those advantages. And as I said, it's a fixed pool, consistent fees. It is the oldest form of collective investment. We've been around since 1868. And what you'll find is when it really works well, there's a very good relationship between the fund management group and the board. And they enjoy that interaction between the two. And they're both obviously working for the shareholders' benefit.
Now, if I go to your website, which is www.theaic.co.uk, there's an impressive range of investment trusts still out there. Can you tell us a little bit more about the sorts of markets and assets they invest in?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's really lots of choice. So, you know, the equity sectors, the investment trusts that invest in shares, they really cover the world, quite honestly. So you have global investment trusts, UK, Europe, Asia, and smaller companies sectors too. And that structure which I've described is really suitable for investing in smaller companies, which are perhaps a bit harder to buy and sell, a bit less liquid than the bigger companies. So we have all of those. But then because of our specific structure, we're also particularly suitable for assets like property. So we have UK commercial property, but we also have a healthcare sector when it comes to property. We have logistics, which are these big warehouses, which, you know, people like Amazon are using. We have private equity, which is unquoted companies, and that's a sector that I particularly find very fascinating. They're buying into companies, working with them, and then either selling them to another buyer or even taking them to IPO. We have infrastructure sector, where they're investing in infrastructure projects like roads, hospitals, and then the renewable energy infrastructure sector, which is investing in solar farms, wind farms, battery storage. So that, you know, there's a real selection of companies. We have some more unusual ones. We have an investment trust that invests in the space sector. We have an investment trust that invests in the forestry sector. We also have a venture capital trusts, which are invest in very small private companies, and as a result of that come with very generous tax breaks. So there's really lots of choice to meet your needs.
And this is these sorts of trusts, I mean, they're actually quite widely available. I mean, who's investing in them? Is it just the wealth managers or just ordinary investors?
No. In fact, I mean, we know who invests in investment trusts. About 50% is held by big institutions. 25% is held by the wealth managers. Retail investors like you and me through our platforms, they hold 23%. And then advisors on advisor platforms hold about 2%. So they, you know, they've got a really diverse range of shareholders who are holding them. And obviously who holds them depends on the type of trust we're talking about. So the equity investment trusts tend to have more retail investors and wealth managers and less institutions, whereas the alternative asset investment trusts, the properties and the infrastructures and the renewable energy infrastructures, they tend to be more held by institutions, although they will still have some wealth managers and private investors too.
And are these the sort of things, as a retail investor, you can put in your ISA?
Absolutely. They can definitely be eligible. They're all eligible for ISAs. They can be put into your SIP if you've got a self-invested personal pension too. We actually do a piece of research every year. And we look at if you'd invested the maximum ISA allowance every year in investment trust. And ISAs are 25 years old, so that's over 25 years. And we look at which investment trust, if you'd done that, would have made you a millionaire. And actually, the research this year showed that 32 of those investment trusts would have made you an ISA millionaire. And two of them, HD Capital and Allianz Technology Trust, would have made you more than £2 million over that period. Now, of course, we just do that. We don't know what are going to be the best performers in the future. Everybody should have a diversified portfolio that's suitable for their needs. But it's an interesting piece of research because it really shows you the value of long-term investing.
That is an amazing number. I remember when you guys put that out. It's just staggering, how much wealth you can create just from investing in investment trusts. You also do something called the Dividend Heroes, which I think illustrates the income creation capabilities of investment trusts as well.
Yeah, investment trusts have a structure which is really suitable for income investors. And the Dividend Heroes kind of explains this. These are the companies that have increased their dividend every year for more than 20 years. And there are 20 of those companies. Interestingly, we have 10 companies who've increased their dividend every year for more than 50 years, which is quite extraordinary. But the structure allows them to do that because they don't have to distribute all their income to their shareholders every year. They can hold back up to 15%, keep it in the reserves. And then when times are tough, and the thing we know about investing is times are tough. So when the pandemic comes along, we had a lot of companies cutting their dividends, then they can use those reserves to boost those dividends for the income investors. So we have a lot of shareholders who are interested in income and they like that reliability of the income.
And that, I presume those Dividend Heroes were able to continue doing that even, in the depths of the pandemic when a lot of companies were freezing their dividends.
Absolutely. I mean, we have, as I said, 20 that have increased their dividend every year for for over 20 years, and 10 of those have increased their dividend for over 50 years. So, I mean, it's an incredible record and very reassuring for investors who are looking for dividends to supplement the way they live.
Now, anyone who starts looking at investment trusts more seriously is going to come across this phrase about discounts to the NAV of the trust. And there's a lot of debate about that in the financial press as well, and there's a lot of trusts trading at a discount. Can you explain a little bit more about how this works and whether this is a good or bad thing for investors?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. So currently, the investment trust industry's average discount is 8%. We actually, at the moment, have a very big company called 3i, which is trading at a 40% premium, which is kind of skewing the figures actually. So if we excluded that one, the discount would be wider. Now, I think I better explain what the discount is. With investment trusts, as I've explained, you buy and sell at the share price, but you can also value them by what's called the net asset value, which is really just like the value of the underlying holdings. If we add up the value of all those underlying holdings, divide them by the number of shares, we're going to get a figure called the net asset value per share. And what the discount is, it's just the difference between the share price and the net asset value. So, if a trust is trading at a discount, and the trust and net asset value figure is 100p per share, and the share price is 90p per share, the difference expressed as a percentage is the discount, and that's a 10% discount. It's where the share price is lower than the net asset value. We do also have some trusts trading at a premium. This is where the net asset value, the underlying holdings, is worth more than more than the share price. So say the trust is trading on the share price of 100p and the net asset value is 90p, then it would be a 10% premium. Now, people get very obsessed about discounts, and over the long term, discount volatility is the thing that really matters, because if you buy and sell at the same discount, it doesn't really make a difference. I think discounts generally are an opportunity for people to buy, but they have to be prepared to do their research to make sure it's really an opportunity. So they have to look at a trust, perhaps compare it with the sector average. If it's on a particularly wide discount in comparison to the sector average, you've got to really do your homework and you've got to think, why? Is it because it hasn't been performing very well? Is the yield unattractive? Is there something about it that is making this trust not attractive to buyers And is that going to change? Because if it's not going to change, it's going to remain at a wide discount. But I have to say, generally at the moment, with these kind of wide discounts we've got going on at the moment, they are attractive to buyers because generally then those discounts will narrow in and you'll get what's known as the double whammy in the trade. Namely, your share price will go up, but also the discount will narrow. So you've got sort of double the value going on. And I can, you know, the discounts really vary from sector to sector. So just give you a couple of examples. For example, renewable energy infrastructure, average discount is 26%, very much out of favor. The global sector, which has lots of the big well-known trusts, 9% discount. And the income sectors, quite a lot of still demand for income. You know, so something like UK equity income is at 6%.
The other thing I wanted to ask about was some of these illiquid strategies, which you've already mentioned. You mentioned private equity. Investment trusts can be a good way, actually, for smaller investors to get access to private equity, which normally would only be available if you've got millions of pounds. But these are illiquid assets, and I know there has been a debate, particularly in the property sector, about investing in more illiquid areas of the market. Do investment trusts represent a good way for the retail investor to get into those more sort of illiquid private asset strategies?
I think they really do. And I mean, I think the issue with the property companies in an open-ended structure is if they've got a lot of people selling those open-ended property unit trusts, then there's kind of a run on that company and they cannot sell the assets quick enough to actually meet those redemptions. And then they end up suspending. Now, investment trusts, as I've explained, it's a company with a fixed pool of capital. You buy and sell at the share price. So if lots of people sell an investment trust, invest in property or a liquid asset, yes, the share price is going to suffer, but you're still going to be able to trade it. So it's a very good way to invest, particularly private equity you mentioned. I mean, I think it's pretty much the only way that private investors can get access to unquoted companies in this way. It's a very long, well-established sector, actually, the private equity investment trust sector, with some very interesting companies. So, no, that structure makes it really suitable for private investors to invest in illiquid assets, hard-to-sell assets through investment trusts.
And there has been some recent discussion in the financial press about some investment trusts being restricted to experienced investors or not being available on particular investment platforms. I found out this myself on one platform I was using. There was an investment trust that particular broker, I won't mention their name, said I couldn't access because it was only for experienced investors. What's going on there? Is that a recent thing where there's been a little bit of a disconnect in the sector?
Yeah. It is a more recent thing, and I have to sympathize with you because it is incredibly frustrating for investors who've gone out, done their research, made a decision which company they want to invest, and then it's almost like computer says no, or in this case, platform says no. And I can explain there's been some very unhelpful cost disclosure regulation for investment trusts, where in addition to the sort of management fee, they're sort of having to also add in a whole range of other costs. So the cost of gearing, for example, has to be included. Any funds they invest in, those costs have to be included. Transaction fees, and that makes for a very big figure. But the thing that's really changed is Consumer Duty has coming, a piece of regulation, which the platforms are responding to. And they have to, investment trusts now have to publish what's called an assessment of value. So they show whether they offer value or not in their assessment of value. And all the assessments of values I've seen say they do. But then the platforms are assessing these assessment value documents. And they are, we think, making a decision based on them whether they offer an investment trust or not. I say we think because the frustrating thing is most of the platforms are not at all clear why they're taking an investment trust off the platform, or even which investment trusts they're taking off the platform, which is very frustrating for us. Because, and actually, if you have got any bad experiences, please do let us know, the AIC know. It's very frustrating for us because we're trying to work out what exactly is going on behind this. And unfortunately, there's been not a lot of transparency from the platforms on this issue. And as the consumer duty is new, so we think it's coming from that. There's one platform that has commissioned external assessment of values documents from a different organisation. And I have seen those documents and they were not of a good quality at all. So I think there needs to be a lot more transparency on what's going on in this issue. But ultimately, also, we are lobbying on this unhelpful cost disclosure regulation to sort that out and to ensure that the Treasury makes a decision on that, and that should help too.
Great. Well, keep a close eye on that as it develops. We talked earlier about this whole relationship between the fund manager and the independent board of directors. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes, and I remember writing about this when I was at the FT, you get a situation where the board of the investment trust actually fires the manager. How frequently does that happen, and why does that happen?
Well, do you know, actually last year was a record year for change of managers like that. We had 9 trusts change their manager in that way last year. It can happen because the board is there to look after shareholders' interests. If they are unhappy with the performance, and this is not going to be like the odd bad year, if they're unhappy over a prolonged period with the performance of the trust, or there could be other issues, perhaps the fund manager who's been managing their trust leaves, and that then they think perhaps, you know, we need to look again. They could have some concerns about the actual fund management group. There are a number of reasons, but if they are unhappy, then they can call what's known in the industry as a beauty parade. So they'll bring in a number of managers who will present to them, and they will weigh up their proposals, and they will also look at the charging structure of those proposals, and then they will make a decision, and they perhaps will move that investment trust to another fund management group. Sometimes they will bring in the same fund management group, will bring in a new fund manager if the board is unhappy with the performance of that company. I mean, it is a very useful feature of investment trusts, because shareholders don't want a company that's just consistently underperforming.
No, absolutely. And these trusts do charge the investors fees as well. I mean, they're like the mutual funds, are they not? There is an annual management fee.
Well, there's an annual management fee. Absolutely. Absolutely. I was saying earlier that a lot of boards have actually reduced the annual management fees this year. I mean, what you'll see with investment trusts, particularly at the moment, are boards are being very proactive. So we've had this year, I think 5 mergers have already going through or proposed for sure, and going through. So that's trusts merging with other trusts, trying to create bigger, more liquid, easily traded companies. We've also seen a lot of management fee changes. We've seen a lot of trusts buying back shares. Last year was a record year for share buybacks. In extreme cases where it's not working out, we're seeing managed wind downs of companies. And personally, I think this is a very positive thing that boards, what they're doing is delivering what shareholders want. So, we have seen, it's, as I said, it's an interesting relationship between the board and the manager. And generally, it's a very good relationship, that clearly if a trust has consistently underperformed, then yes, they can actually change the manager.
And why does a trust decide to buy back shares? What's the motivation there?
Well, that would be to address. Normally, discount is part of it, but it's not per se to address the discount. Perhaps what it will do is put a floor under the discount. So, say the trust decides that they don't want the discount going wider than 10%, then that, you know, some companies actually have what's called a discount control strategy, where then they will announce and make it public that they want to manage their discount within, you know, it's not to go wider than, say, than 10%. And then when those shares go above that level, then they will buy back in their shares. So it's partly addressing discounts, but it's not just about that, because obviously if you're buying back in shares, there are less shares in issue, so you're enhancing or increasing the net asset value figure. So there's a benefit for shareholders. Also, shareholders see Trust buying back in their shares, and they recognise that that board is, you know, taking action to help them when it's a tough time and there's not that much demand.
And so investors, you know, if they want to find out more about investment trusts and they want to research them and compare them, where can they go for more information on that? And what sort of metrics should they be using when they stack up?
Yeah, well, I do think our website is a great place to start, theaic.co.uk. I mean, we have data on all our member companies. I mean, clearly you're going to have a look at your performance data. You're going to look at the past performance data. I also like to look at the discrete data, the year-on-year data, to see how managers have performed in different market conditions. You're going to look at the charges. You're going to look at the portfolio. If you're an income investor, you know, you're definitely going to have a look at that dividend yield figure. We've talked extensively about discounts. You're going to look at, if you're researching a sector, you're going to look at the discounts for the trusts in that sector. You're going to look at how they vary from the sector average, and you're just going to think why. And quite often, you know, the ones on narrow discounts have performed very well, but you need to do your research then to see whether the, you know, there may be a trust on a wider discount that represents a buying opportunity. You're also going to have a look at the gearing figure, how much that trust borrows. I mean, to be honest, for conventional sort of equity type trusts, it's normally not more than about 15%. Property, if you think about it, we've got those of us who've got mortgages, you know, that's effectively gearing, borrowing to invest in a house. Not surprising, again, in the investment trust sector, the property companies tend to have higher levels of gearing. And also you can look at things like the report and accounts and the fact sheet. They're all there on the AIC site. I think you can really get a good insight into a trust from reading through the report and accounts, looking at the chair's statements and the fund management statement. And we will also include things like research. So any research on this company will also be available on the AIC site. I think if you've had a look there, then I think you should be in a pretty good position. Of course, your website has got some great investment trust stories and information. So also investors should take a look there too.
Well, no, I have to agree with you. I think the your site is actually fantastic. It has a lot of very useful information, and it's a good first port of call if you want to get a good feel for the universe of investment trusts out there.
Do it.
No, honestly, I use it a lot myself. I do like it. I do like it. Well, thank you very much indeed, Annabelle, for coming on the podcast this afternoon. That's been a very useful introduction to investment trusts, and we will look forward to getting you back on in the near future for further discussions on this sector.
I look forward to it.
You've been listening to the Armchair Trader podcast. Make sure you visit our website, www.thearmchairtrader.com, for your daily dose of financial markets news, and sign up to our free newsletter there.